Hello, and welcome to Beyond the Balance Sheet. This is our fourth podcast. I am your host, Michael Pasquale, a financial advisor and partner with the Soteria Wealth Management Team at UBS Financial Services here in New York City. As always, I can be reached at michael.pasquale@ubs.com. Today, I am thrilled to be joined by Maris Pasquale Dorn, a psychotherapist, speaker, author, and the creator of Midlife Mother, Pause, Reset, Reclaim. Most importantly, Maris is my sister. Maris is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, and the views that she will share today are her own. In this episode, we are continuing our theme of women's wealth and well-being, and we will explore the psychology behind how women relate to money, responsibility, identity, and the major wealth transitions that so many women are stepping into. Maris, welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me. Hi.
All right. So we're going to jump right in, as we always do, and try to keep this as conversational as possible. And again, Maris, thank you so much for your time. So before we get into your work, can you share a bit about your background, where you grew up, what shaped you early on, what drew you to psychotherapy, what drew you to writing, and what drew you to sort of what you're doing now so passionately in terms of working with women?
Yeah. Well, hi, thanks for having me and appreciate the question and the background. So I grew up, as you know, in rural central Pennsylvania, Hershey, Pennsylvania. I went to Georgetown undergrad, majored in psychology. I got my master's degree at Columbia, where I later returned as faculty to teach in their MSW program. And I've been in private practice for a number of years. I've had my clinical licensure. I've been working for almost two decades in this world. I was initially, when I was very young, very intrigued by the brain. I loved the concept of the brain. We had a babysitter, well, I did, in Hershey, PA, who was in medical school. And she showed me brain scans, and that was it. I thought I was going to grow up and become a neurosurgeon or a neuroscientist. And life evolves. I found my passion really more in the therapeutic relationship. I had a sliding doors moment of possibly working at a lab at Stanford University and realized that the thing I was most excited about was less looking at the scans and more about greeting the families that would be coming in and talking about the reason they were there and how they were coping. And that's what led to my going to get my MSW and the social work field and then becoming a psychotherapist. The people that I work with in my private practice are both men and women. And I've seen more and more and more as I approach midlife myself and am in midlife myself, I am experiencing this alongside my clients, my peers. I also had a few really significant moments. And of course, you shared it with me, Mike, our father getting sick with pancreatic cancer, dying very shortly thereafter, and dying the same week as New York City shut down for COVID when I had a 5 and 7-year-old underfoot 24 hours a day. Really enhanced what I do and what I offer clients. I have always been intrigued by and practice nervous system regulation. That experience required my really leaning into that mindfulness practice, that regulatory practice deeply, not because I had the bandwidth, but exactly because I did not, and allowed me to show up in a way that while, and all people, not just women, but we're speaking about women here, that identity, those role collisions that happen, right? Daughter, wife, mother, professional often can collide and compete. And to be able to be truly present to each one when you're in it is a practice, is an actual skill that is not natural. Mm-hmm. We have to practice it to get into the place that we want to. And the women that I work with now are constantly saying things like, I'm pulled in a million directions. I'm everywhere and nowhere. They're not having any sort of stability. And much of the time, the skills that brought them to where they are right here today, those tools, they got them here. That's a beautiful thing. We're not trying to shed that or shame that. We're just trying to say, are those the same tools, the same value systems, the same voice in your head to go through this next chapter when we're looking more at aging ourselves, losing parents, launching children? There are a lot of layers of grief here. There is also an enormous opportunity for empowerment, enormous opportunity for true agency, for legacy building, wealth, and beyond.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Thank you. So, Maris, you created Midlife Mothers, Pause, Reset, Reclaim. What was happening in your clinical work and in your own life that made you realize women needed something different than, quote unquote, just push through it? Mm-hmm. And with that being said, you know, what moments or patterns led you to focus on women in midlife? And I know you talked briefly about our father and that sort of convergence of all of those things. But maybe beyond that as well, was there certain trigger points that sort of pointed you in this direction?
Totally. Well, so one, I and all of my peers are in this chapter also. So I could see, even socially, from sure a clinical and professional lens, but socially, where women were struggling. The amount of women who say those comments I said before, being pulled in every direction, of not showing up fully, of the enormous stress they're holding, trying to make decisions around their parents' care, being parentified now, right? So we are someone's child, and then we are parentified in this role. Watching grief and how it settles and resurfaces for each of us, my clients, my peers. Watching the relationship change. When you lose a parent, how the relationship with the remaining parent changes so significantly. The sibling dynamic and relationship, how it can shift and change. And in modern day, we're living in a different world now. So generations before, we had role models. We had more traditional gender roles. We often were raising families within a similar region, if not neighborhood, as extended family, as multi-generations. We're much more dispersed now. We have this urgency culture also, this accessibility culture that is new because of these phones, because of our accessibility. This has been a wonderful asset for most of us. We can work from home. We can go to the kids' play, then log back in. It has given us a lot of flexibility. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it also means that now the blurred boundaries are further blurred between who we are. And I'm not talking about compartmentalizing who we are. You know, now I'm professional. Now I am mom. Now I am child. They will and need to integrate. And when we're present in a particular situation, I am seeing more and more women, especially in midlife, talk about their reactivity, being so deeply uncomfortable with their reactivity. So many of these moments of inputs that are guilt-driven. I feel guilty about this. I'm not fully here. I'm not fully there. I'm not fully anywhere. And this guilt and shame cycle, which, by the way, only keeps us wildly activated. So none of that is actually helping us be present, even when we feel it. So I was seeing this more and more and more, and noticing that we are starting to get a little more buzzwords, probably because of social media, nervous system regulation, mindfulness, all these parts. Perimenopause is another huge one. So women in midlife are talking about perimenopause more and more. This conversation is growing and evolving, and I think it's awesome. It needs more attention. We need more research, right? I am not trying to minimize that conversation at all. We're missing a part. Lots of the conversations—
And perimenopause, when you say that, for me and maybe for the audience, what exactly is that timeline or time frame? Is that, that's pre, I assume, but like, how long can that last? And what is the, you know, data— Tell us around that.
So it circles menopause, right? So it's the time surrounding, peri, it's the time surrounding. And we're talking about it, and it's different for every woman. So it really begins typically when we start to notice symptoms. And it's just because our estrogen is erratic. It's chaotic. And then in menopause, which the technical definition, not an MD, is that you have not had you haven't menstruated in a year. And at that point thereon, you are in menopause. Right. And at that point, your estrogen is
so it's
very,
not pre,
very, very
actually.
Low.
I was wrong in that. It's the circular,
it's kind of this
life cycle around the period of time.
This period of time, and we're talking about it really typically with perimenopause, of leading up to, right? Because you're in that period of, and a lot of women are like, am I in menopause? I don't know. It's been 3 months. Will I get it? Will I not? I still have these symptoms. There are a lot of symptoms that surround it. The symptoms are real. The physical symptoms are unrelenting at times, right? When we're talking about perimenopause and mental health, perimenopause and let's say anxiety, okay? Perimenopause didn't cause the mental health. Estrogen, at the risk of getting too detailed here, estrogen supports the architecture. Estrogen affects things like mood stabilizers, neurotransmitters, et cetera. These things that affect mood and sleep, they affect mental health. So estrogen is sort of the scaffolding. And when that scaffolding becomes vulnerable, everything else is a little more obvious. It's not a cause and effect. Perimenopause doesn't equal anxiety. The women that I'm seeing clinically and often peers sort of are acting like, I got to grip and hold on until this is over. I got to clench my way through until this is over. Or maybe some are finally exploring other interventions, physical interventions, et cetera. Some people aren't eligible for those. For whatever reason, it may not be the appropriate intervention for many of us. So this kind of grin and bear it, or just like hold on till it's over, this perimenopause, this disruption, this hormonal chaos is really shining a light on what is already happening in this chapter. What is the fact that we are launching kids, our parents are aging and dying, our spouses and peers are. The gatherings that we are going to are less baby showers and weddings and celebratory. We are showing up with a friend for a meal because she's in treatment. because her parent has died, because her spouse is going through a massive transition, right? So life is, and I don't mean that to be dark. I mean it to say like, these are beautiful opportunities to say, wow, life has changed. These tools that got me here aren't necessary. This push through, this success, this climb that ladder, women are stopping and being like, I didn't even know I was on a ladder. It was obvious when, I'll just use myself, right? When it was like, do well in high school, do well at Georgetown, graduate cum laude so that you can get into grad school, go to the Ivy League, success, success, achieve, achieve. I don't want to shed that. Let's maintain all of that. That's a value to me. And let's be aware of where it's enacted. Let's be aware of what success means to me, of what I want my legacy to look like, right? Especially when it comes to mothering, which many women in midlife are. And so many are so worried. They're realizing there's only so much more time with our kids and the priorities that you want to have. And I know you experience this, a really special, beautiful, continued adult relationship, even when they no longer live full-time with you. It's that holding of both, this celebration, liberty, freedom, along with a mourning and a loss and an anxiety over, well, in these last 18 years, did I establish it? Are we okay? Worried they're going to be remembered as like haggard or absent or too focused on the wrong thing. And the reality is, even when we don't have a lot of the FaceTime, can we truly be present where we are when we are? That's going to help us with conflict. That's going to help us with decision making. That's going to help us be responsive rather than reactive.
Right. That's great. Thank you. I want to shift a little bit more with these themes and how it relates to finance and money and decision making that may go beyond that. And with the psychotherapist lens and hat that you wear, and our theme thus far, at least for our podcast, being women's wealth and well-being, what would you say are the most common emotional undercurrents that shape how women relate to money?
So culture and family of origin are huge. Are women approaching money and wealth from a lens of scarcity or abundance? That's not just women, right? Mm-hmm. That's people. That's how much we believe that is an energy that will flow, that will come to us, that we are, quote, deserving of. Mm-hmm. The unique lens that many women come to is that there have not been in our past, recent history and culture, a lot of examples of very wealthy women, whether that's women in the C-suite, whether that is women founders, they're more and more ever now, and they're still very much lower numbers than men. We've lived in a culture where men are the decision makers typically around wealth. Now, I'm not talking about like a marketing company who's saying, hey, I know that I'm advertising to the mom who's buying the toilet paper. We know that women make certain decisions in their household, a lot around domesticity. I'm talking about wealth, how to really spend money, how to build that legacy, where that wealth distribution is going, whether intergenerationally to charities, all of that, right? We don't have a lot of the modeling or examples. There is also, you know, a lot of this wealth transfer, you tell me, you have the data, I'm sure, is yes, from women who are increasingly or have increasingly built that wealth themselves. A lot of it is because of inheritance. And that inheritance, what I see with women who have inherited and are now the stewards of extraordinary wealth, this idea of, is it mine? Whose value, whose direction guides what to do with it? This idea of monetary privilege and what we owe, right? Mm-hmm. The discomfort in a room. I mean, when you look around a room specific to wealth, there are typically less women. Mm-hmm. Right? So this lack of role modeling, this culture that's sort of built around, not sort of, is built around male decision makers when it comes to wealth and value systems. So, and especially when it's inherited, and especially when it is in that acute moment where that person has recently deceased and they are having to hold two things at the same time, which is enormous grief, not even just too many things, enormous grief, all of a sudden this wildly increased wealth and responsibility, which can be so heavy to hold, very confusing, sometimes extraordinarily liberating, while this weight of grief is anchored. You know, those are tough to hold, both of those things. And what part of ourselves is leading when we're actually meeting with the advisors, making the decisions, right? So how they grew up, how money was spoken about, and how we were brought into the room. That's another piece, is that oftentimes sons have been brought into the room to talk about money, what to do with the money, to teach them how to be stewards of money, whether that's about balancing a checkbook and supporting a family in a more simple way or at a much larger scale in terms of wealth distribution. daughters, women have not typically been brought into that role in the same way. And another huge piece, there are many, women are the primary caretakers. So right now, I think the data is something like 70 to 80% of familial caretakers are women. Why? Because the husband often dies first and the wife has taken care of him, and then daughters care for parents. And so we have not only come into that wealth immediately as a wealth transfer moment, but there's often been a period of time of caretaking. If these women have the privilege of wealth and there are aids and resources, that's wonderful. Nothing will remove the emotional load of the caretaking, of that collision of daughter and mother, of professional and daughter, of that time stretch. So they're arriving at this moment with all of these pieces affiliated with loss, really, along with this enormous gain.
Right. We had the pleasure of doing a podcast a couple of days ago with Mary Ellen Iskandarian, who's the CEO of the Women's World Bank. Some of the data she provided was fascinating in terms of the learning part, which is a big focus for what we're trying to do with these podcasts, is trying to get just advocacy for financial literacy. We're focusing on women just because of this massive generational change that's happening. And as a society, we need to be prepared for it. Yeah. But it's not just women. It's our young people, our children are not being exposed to financial literacy at any point in their education. And she made a very interesting point that her data and the Women's World Bank data would show that if you miss the educational opportunity, I believe it was like 7 years old or 8 or 9 years old, you missed it, period. From that point on, it was all about the child or the young adult learning through experience and not through an educational process. Like, so get out of the classroom and actually teach them. Your point about being pulled into the room and having a conversation is so critical. It's very frustrating to me when I have friends or family members or clients who either are in that patriarch or matriarch situation and they have not had the discussion with their children. Yeah. They have not pulled all their children in. They have not sat around the table and talked about liquidity, longevity, and legacy, which are the three biggest things that they need to be focused on. It's an unbelievably stubborn stance that I think from our parents' generation, they still have. I take comfort in our generations being much more transparent in that regard. But I thought that was a fascinating data point. And to your point earlier about what women do, especially women who have been successful on their own, entrepreneurs. Now, we're talking, Women's World Bank is primarily focused on underdeveloped countries. But this applies also to the U.S. and to Western Europe and areas that are not considered that. When a woman has, I want to make sure I get her data right, when a woman has been successful and has capital, has money, I'd be interested to know what you think, but where do you think they immediately go with that resource, that capital? You know, clothing, vacationing?
Oh, no. I mean, I
cosmetics, where?
I can't imagine the
answer is it's twofold. It immediately goes to their children.
Yep.
And then it immediately goes to their siblings, and it immediately goes to education. Those three are where they put the money. So if it was, they couldn't afford school, period, now they can. They afforded school, but it was a lousy situation. Now they go to a better school. They couldn't afford college. Now they are. They couldn't afford graduate school. Now they are. And making sure that the family is all experiencing that wealth from her is the number one priority for them. And the only thing that that woman focuses on for herself is if she's pregnant and the life and the status and making sure that she is taking care of herself and her body and her emotions because she's carrying a baby. If she was not, her priority about herself is not even remotely on that category. These are wealthy women we're talking about right now. And that's how her data has come back and shown. And Mary Ellen is an amazing, fascinating woman who's been doing this for many, many years in an unbelievable capacity, solving a lot of problems in the world.
Incredible.
And so I would take what she's been exposed to the bank. And, and I thought that was awesome.
And I
bring it up because I'd be interested. Your face, you know, the audience is not going to see this because we're just audio, but like your face is like, yeah, I get that. I guess I kind of got it too, but I was like, well, that's interesting because, you know, I would have said, if it was me, yes, 100%. If I was in a position where I needed to do those things for all those people around me, yes, for sure. But I would have definitely set some aside for me. Like, you know, you name it. Like I would have been out there spending it, but it's just not a priority, not even close to take care of themselves.
You know, not surprised by that data because we see this across the board, not just with wealth, about women and where they put time and resources into themselves or not. And typically it's not. It will be to loved ones and community before self. What a beautiful value, right? So I'm never working with women to say, let's shed that, let's judge that. You can maintain that, and two things are always true, often more, right? That can exist. And is there space for, let's call it deservedness? Is there space for something for self? And it doesn't need to be a fancy car when it's wealth. Can it be just simply space? Something for yourself. So this comes up with women all the time. Concepts of deservedness, concepts of whose wealth is this? What do I owe? All of those parts are rooted in culture. We live in a patriarchal culture. We can't deny it. It exists. We are shifting. We are changing. This wealth distribution will be part of it. Women are going to have a lot more power in terms of where they put their money and their wealth. That's going to be really significant and be part of a humongous culture shift, which is extraordinary. And how are they shepherded through it? And it starts early. We don't want to bring women into the room when they're grieving, women into the room when they've just reached a certain pinnacle or are selling their business. We don't want to bring women in the room when they're at the inflection point. They need to understand not just how to manage their money, but if indeed it is an inheritance, then what did that other person value? What did they want? Why are they the steward of it? How do they want that to be passed on? Is there trust there? Because that's the piece I see most often in my practice and amongst the midlife women I worked with. It goes back to this deservedness concept, right? Especially for those women who may not have worked to the same level as their parent or their spouse when that spouse dies. And so whose money is this to do what with? And am I deserving of having it and or making the decisions with it? It's not going to happen at the point of crisis. That clarity comes from having been in the room early, from understanding. And I recommend this to people outside of wealth, of course, but with your parents, your spouse, your friends, your loved ones, to really understand who are they? What do they want? What are the things they really value? That much of those concepts get crystallized as we age and towards the end of our lives. These are conversations that, you know, we say in this area that these are conversations that everyone thinks are too soon until they're too late.
Yeah.
And let us be aware, this is what you're doing, which I love, that is inclusive of wealth. Right? Yep. Let it not be too late. Bring them in
right.
Much, 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 much earlier. It is enough when someone passes to handle the emotional load and the extraordinary roller coaster of just what that person was to you and the fact that they are now gone. Not to mention our brain can't manage it, can't manage that change, the unpredictability, all of it. So anything that we can talk about beforehand, to be aligned on beforehand, to bring someone in on prior to that wealth transfer is pivotal to make it genuinely easier for them. Yep. It's not a load that you're putting on them, a responsibility you're transferring too early. It's inviting them into the room. And if you missed it yep. when they were seven, don't throw that out, right? Bring them in now. There are always the opportunities to bring them in, your children and the women, and supporting the women. That's the other thing we were just talking about off camera, right? Supporting women, because now we do see that women will lift up their families and their communities. And when a woman, there's such good data I don't have immediately accessible, but when a woman is successful of how that impacts their immediate community is extraordinary. It's extraordinary.
It's what we're learning is it's less and less about protecting that wealth and growing that wealth and more, not that that's not important. And in fact, for us, that's very important. We stress that particularly for those that don't think about it, but you know, it's the sharing of that wealth and the sharing of that resource and the capital to create better scenarios for others. It's just abundantly more clear for women that that's a priority. And the data shows us that. Just the societal impact of what could happen with $114 trillion changing hands, the primary beneficiary being women, like that could end up being not only good for assets and capital, but also for the greater society as a whole.
And, totally. Look at these giant wealthy men, Bill Gates and Amazon. Look, they're ex-wives and look what they're doing, right? It is an opportunity for massive shift and change. And oftentimes, and it, you know, probably does shift across gender lines where the goalpost of wealth and increased wealth is not the same. A woman, the goalpost is not the wealth, it's the impact.
Yeah, right. That's actually a really good point. I mean, I have to steal that phrase. For a listener who feels anxious or tends to avoid conversations about money, what is one practical tool or small reset that you would recommend to have before that hard conversation?
Awesome. So there
have I would imagine you have this question posed to you a lot, not just about money, but any conversation, a spousal situation, a tough conversation with a son, a daughter, a parent, a friend.
Exactly. Before I run any group, before I have private one-on-ones, before I speak to an audience, we always set our space. And I strongly recommend that people do that privately. It can be invisible and it can be one moment, or it can be 5 minutes in a bathroom stall or before you leave your own home, and really private, right? So it doesn't have to be super exaggerated. Breath is such an underutilized tool. We're doing it all day anyway. Let it work for you. Okay, so I'm not going to get lost in the weeds here too much about the nervous system or neuroscience. What I will say is that we have a fight or flight system and we have a calm and rest system. I'm oversimplifying, but it's a little bit of a seesaw, right? And when we're in this fight or flight, we're really activated. We're feeling high anxiety. We can actually turn on the part of the nervous system that is the calm and cool down system so we can show up more regulated. That can help us be more present in the room so that we are able to receive and respond rather than showing up in an activated place where we are reactive. And to do that, breath is one of the biggest ones. So it is that big inhale and making sure that breath goes the entire way through the belly like a baby breathes. Almost every adult I know, myself included, stops in the throat or the chest. We think breathing deeply is chest and throat breath. It is not. Breathing all the way through the belly, making that exhale longer and slower, and being aware to drop shoulders, loosen jaw. Most of us are running around throughout the day tense. And it just goes back to being cave people, right? You exit your cave and there's a lion and you have to get into fight or flight. This is the positioning. A lot of us are running through our work day or our family moments in the same positions. Our bodies, our brains, who are extraordinarily intelligent and gorgeous and advanced, are also simple. They're about survival. And we are getting the cues from our body that there is a threat. We will then turn on the threat response. We are in fight or flight. Actively pushing down those shoulders, slowing down that breath turns on the calm down systems. Yep. Fact. The other thing that is a really 60 seconds of hard jumping jacks or some major exercise is another good one. Cold water is awesome. So if you're truly in a place of like, you know, really getting activated, I like to think about like a pot on water as it's boiling. And remember that boiling over is that wild activation. That is that my nervous system is as activated as possible. There's a lion chasing me. I'm running. Okay. A lot of us, and the women that I'm working with especially, have realized that they're never actually cooling down. That pot is never cooling down. It only gets a little less hot. So you're always able to activate. So when we can take those micro moments throughout the day to regulate, that repetition matters more than effort. Repetition matters more than effort. You can do it anytime you pee or in the car. Increasing that breath, that loosening, being more mindful in your life, which I can get into at probably too much length than we have, but it can be as simple as brushing your teeth. How many of us get up in the morning and all of a sudden we're brushing our teeth? We're like, well, I don't know how I got here, but I'm here now, right? Actually being aware of when we step, when we brush, when we smell the soap. We don't smell the soap because you deserve to smell lavender in the morning and it's lovely. That's great. That's a nice self-care moment. Cool. If you can have a relaxing shower, that's good for all of us. What it is actually doing is training your brain to be mindful, to be in the moment. Nobody gets up and runs a marathon. We think we can just be present because we'd like to be. Willpower doesn't get you there. Period. It is practice. It is an actual skill set to build and develop. Real quick, back to cold water as just another very kind of immediate one is really powerful. So all the more so if you have an ice bucket, you can throw your face into it. Great. If you have that, that's really wonderful. Your brain is going to read that dive reflex. We're going underwater. Just as we don't realize when we're blinking, it slows heart rate. It turns on that parasympathetic nervous system to calm and cool down. Okay. The other one is if you don't have access to that, you're at work, you're going into that meeting, whatever might be happening, just get really cold water on your wrists, on your hands. Ground yourself here in the present moment. When our brain is going, it is reflecting on the past to take that information, to try to predict the future. It's all about safety and survival. It's doing its job. Nothing's wrong with you. This is actually what it is supposed to be doing. Everything is working as intended. Now it is our job to show up in it and say, I'm actually safe here. I am not at threat. I will use the things I have in my body at my disposal that are free and accessible and private anytime I need and want to regulate myself, establish safety so that I'm out of fight or flight and I can show up in this room to a difficult conversation, to a fight with my spouse, to a moment with an advisor, more clear, with more clarity, to be present. Now, in my actual program, when I work with clients, we work on regulation first because then we're also diving into what are the stories you're telling yourself? What is the narrative behind all this? Where do these values come from? What is the voice pounding in your head? Whose voice is it? Do you want to still listen? Right? Mm-hmm. It may be your 12-year-old self that had to cope and adapt in a certain way. You don't want at 50 years old for your 12-year-old self to drive your decisions. And of course they do, because at one point that was a skill. It was an adaptation. It was a coping mechanism. It worked. It's not working anymore. It is now in the way. It is causing dysregulation. We aren't carving it out like a lobotomy. We're greeting it compassionately and saying, you're not going to get to drive my interaction here. I'm going to go into this meeting clear, regulated, and present. That will help us be more responsive rather than reactive.
That's great. Thank you. Can we stay on this topic just a little bit more and segue also into some of these traits, characteristics, skills relative to your book? So you're also a New York Times bestselling author. Name of the book is Piper Chen Sings. What did writing about confidence and performance anxiety teach you that applies to adult women stepping into potentially wealth, visibility, leadership, things like that?
Oh, awesome. Thank you for that, because we originally
maybe give a little background on the book, too, before you go into that. Yeah,
absolutely. So our sister-in-law, Philippa Sue of Hamilton fame, she and I wrote a children's book that came out in 2024 called Piper Chen Sings. Mm-hmm. We had a million and one iterations. I won't get into all the various moments of the book and writing the book. Where we landed was on addressing our earliest readers. So 3 to 5-year-olds, kids who are reading with a grown-up. Mm-hmm. And we focused on, Philippa had always been asked, what would you tell your younger self? And what do you do when you get stage fright, or do you still? So the book is really an answer to that for her. My participation as a psychotherapist and with this lens as a mindfulness practitioner, nervous system regulation focused, was that we were able to take this very accessible character, who, by the way, is a Chinese American character. So that was important to us also in terms of representation. We were able to take this character, Piper Chen, and have her experience two feelings at once, in a very simple way that everyone can relate to. She loves to sing. She gets offered a solo in the spring sing, and she immediately clams up. She gets real nervous. It's an intergenerational.
So wait, this is her first opportunity. She gets super nervous and
she clams up.
Freaked out.
She clams up when she gets told. It's an intergenerational story. We pepper in some Chinese language. So of course, that part was really important to us also in terms of representation. And she goes to her nanai, her paternal grandmother, and she's supportive and she talks to her about the moments that she has felt both nervous and excited. And that's the real concept, this dialectic, this holding of both nervous and excited, processing the two, acknowledging that both exist. We're not using but language. I'm nervous, but I'm excited. I'm nervous and I'm excited. Both are actually true, even though they seem opposed. We adults have much more complicated moments of this. They exist all the time for us. This is a very elementary, accessible version of it. She is nervous and excited. She's able to process with a loved one. She takes a pause and she chooses. Does she want to do it? Yes, she does. Which part of herself gets to lead all the stuff we've been talking about today is the part of her that knows she loves to sing and she wants that part to lead. She's gonna feel nervous. So she's not pretending it doesn't exist. The tool she has is that she says hello to these butterflies. She acknowledges that anxiety. She says hello. She establishes safety. She doesn't try to compartmentalize, because when we do that, guess what? It's going to come knocking. It's going to come out in back pain and panic attacks. This is what happens when we try to shove aside a part of ourselves that's been ringing alarm bells. We say, I see you. I understand that I am also nervous. I am also excited. And I choose to do this with agency, with intention. And she does, and she shines, and it's wonderful, and yada, yada.
How was she taught that?
The grandmother says, I say hello to the butterflies.
Got it.
Right? Now, look, this book is for 3 to 5-year-olds. It's very elementary.
Yeah. Yeah.
The grown-ups, and it's specifically so that the grown-ups can read to them. We wrote it in a rhythmic, lyrical form because we knew it would be a read aloud. So that was really fun. I mean, there was many creative pieces that we loved about it in terms of my psychotherapist hat and how I was able to add these themes into it, it was very intentional because grownups are reading to this age group. And this is an opportunity for them to process. When is the time that you felt nervous and excited, et cetera? It's also, frankly, for a lot of grownups and those certainly who haven't been through this type of work or experienced their own therapy, et cetera, this is one of the first times they're really putting to language what they're experiencing many days, right? Look at grief. I am so grateful for the relationship we had. I am so devastated this person is gone. I am so grateful for this wealth and this liberty it provides me. I am so devastated that the person has died. I am so overwhelmed it has been bestowed to me. They seem to oppose, and then we fight them or we try to put some aside, and both are true. And that's what we delivered through the messaging of that book.
That's great. How is the book doing? I assume selling like hotcakes?
Yeah, it's off the, it's not even on shelves.
I only bought 10,000 of them on Amazon.
Oh, you're the best. Picture books are not, they are not the driver to the largest wealth transfer.
Not yet. When it turns into an animated movie, maybe.
We got such critical feedback. Therapists have come to me and talked to me about how they use it. And that has been one of the most poignant and profound parts of this is that people within my profession, I kind of had thought like, well, there's sort of two different things, but they kind of have some alignment. It's like to really experience that full overlap in the work that I do has been very meaningful to me personally.
Well, I think my own layman's opinion is sometimes therapy is as easy as a 3 to 5 year old picture book. It doesn't have to be super deep. And it sometimes is just the traits that Piper was able to learn being applied in people's lives. Sometimes is the answer. It's not always something that needs to be unearthed. Maybe they just need skills similar to what we're experiencing with financial education and literacy is we're just not teaching these things like in mass or in a broader setting. So it's a shame, but I've hoped that all of this will continue to grow, even if it's just organic and us doing our own little part of that. As women are increasingly becoming primary stewards of wealth, you had actually used the word steward earlier, which I thought was great. We're trying to get that much more out in the domain. Where do you think the financial system still falls short in accommodating particularly how women process and make decisions? And if you could put more of a financial lens on it, that'd be great. But I think it's probably apropos to a lot of the conversations that you're having in your line of work as well.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, a lot of what we've touched on a bit before is a piece of it is that it has been male dominated. The decision makers have been men. And so now that women will be the decision makers, when are they part of the conversation? That's a shortfalling, that they're coming to the conversation at time of crisis rather than being included throughout the entire picture. That is a big part. Now, there's opportunity. There are many that are doing the work as you are, which is wonderful and extraordinary. There is also, women are holding so many roles at once, and they are often re-identifying themselves in this chapter. So most of the women that are going to be recipients are midlife and beyond, midlife or aged women themselves. And that consideration of what their own legacy and their familial legacy means is going to drive their decisions. And a lot of it is based on what role is the most present for them. So when we can actually identify and peel apart the layers of all the roles that they're holding, women use the word balance a lot. How do you balance X, Y, Z? I love the word integration because there's not typically a balance. You know, it's often a seesaw that's never perfectly balanced. As well, we're integrating more than two things. We're not balancing work and home. We're not balancing wealth or giving. We are balancing an entire intricate, sticky web of self that has come to this point and to this picture. And that sort of recreating identity at this time based on who you've always been. So many, many, many women at this chapter are realizing, and you've probably heard this, right? Women are done people pleasing, right? I'm done. Done people pleasing. I'm done responding to everybody else's needs. Where am I? They have been holding on for often decades in chronic activation and service of others, because oftentimes that was the lessons we were given, is that that is what to do. Even if you are also primary breadwinner, even if you are also an entrepreneur, no matter where you are in your dynamic, you are also going to be attending to the needs of everybody else. As you said, that the woman from the Women's World Bank so beautifully spoke to you about in terms of the data. So how did we get here? What are all the parts that are here right now? And instead of sort of just reacting that I'm done. It's about me. I get to choose stake in the ground. It's let's unfold all that. Let's look at all those layers of what got here. Let's look at the fact that you are assigned certain roles. Let's look at the value you have in terms of characteristics, right? Things like, you know, like I know for myself, I absolutely define I am responsible. I am timely, I am professional, right? I'm efficient, all these things. I don't want to get rid of those things. I actually love them about myself. I only want to continue to hone in on those things and those characteristics. And where do those things show up sometimes? Where they're taking over. So what do I mean? Like, you're a really, really beautiful friend, right? I'm a really beautiful friend. I show up for people. That's a value I hold really deeply. People know I will show up for them. I am emotionally available. I validate and I will show up for them. Beautiful. If I'm at dinner and I'm on my cell phone feeling stressed because I need to respond to the text chain, because I need to sign up for the meal train, that is taking me out of the role I'm in that moment with my child. And I know that's meaningful to me too. The thing that is driving is this pressure of, I attend everyone's needs. I attend to everybody. I must show up here, right? So really that excavation, and you know, you said this earlier, and I both agree and disagree that oftentimes that therapeutic concept, it can just be skill set. Well, that's a beautiful starting point. Well, what do I actually do to get to a place of regulation so that I can start to excavate of what's really going on for me? That's actually my program, right? Because in the program, I don't wear a psychotherapist hat. It's not based on my licensure. It's based on my experience. And it's more as a guide and a facilitator to say, here are a bunch of lessons. This is all the education and the training about it. And then let's meet as a group and get in and dig of how this is actually coming up for you in your life. Very skill oriented, because that is something that people want. They say, give me the tools so that I can feel a little better, so that I can go through the transformation that I want, so that I can increase my awareness, so that I can show up in my life more fully. And that exists in a financial institution, that exists in a wealth conversation, and well beyond.
There's one question I always close out with all of our guests, and it goes like this. Beyond the balance sheet, what does wealth and well-being mean to you personally? Take your author hat off, your psychotherapist hat off, and just think about wealth and well-being. And what are the first things that come to your mind, Maris?
Totally. Liberty, freedom.
Good one. Freedom comes up a lot. That's interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we know there's only a certain point and et cetera, right? But no. What wealth can provide us, and it is very easy, and this comes up with women, right? Yuck. Money, yuck. I don't want to be so focused on money. I don't want money to be a driver. I don't want to feel materialistic, that kind of thing. So anyway, I'll take that hat off. But for me, that is absolutely it, right? Wealth equates to liberty and freedom. It does provide a foundation on which you have more choice. And we can't deny that. That can exist beyond, right? Is it about more choice because now my immediate needs are met? Wonderful. And then is there real choice, liberty, and freedom to say, where do I have impact beyond? Now it's my freedom. You know, women, wealth, and well-being, right? To say, well, what means something to me? What means something to me? And then where can I bestow that so that I know I have real impact? Because we all know, I mean, this is the thing that we go through at this phase of life. And I find it empowering and beautiful. I know many find it scary and dark. We're all going to the same end. I mean, the only thing we know is we're going to be gone at some point. And what is the legacy we're leaving? Well, wealth and well-being gives us that opportunity to both show up as the person we want to be in terms of our legacy, the relationships, right? People will always remember how you made them feel. They don't always remember what you said, what you did. They will always remember how you made them feel. And then if we have the wealth as a part of that too, to say, well, gosh, that gave me the liberty and the freedom to show up more in these parts, to offset some of these things, to hire out some of these other parts. It is a part of it. It can be that foundation that allows us to enhance our well-being in many ways. And I don't mean because you get to go to fancy spa days. I mean because you can have more space for actual reflection, stillness, and investment in the things that matter. And to most women I know, and to myself, that's relationships. We also know that social relationships are the actual data that leads towards longevity.
Oh, 100%. The data is like...
The data is it.
Is unbelievably skewed towards those social relationships, particularly as we age. And it's marrying that with well-being and with wealth and with the inheritance that's coming and with all the entrepreneurs that are monetizing their wealth, it's the greatest numbers we've ever seen by multiple factors for women above the age of 40 are at the precipice of monetizing their businesses. We've never seen anything like this. And so this is such a cool and amazing opportunity for us all to be a part of and to play a little bit of a role in all of this. It's an honor. It's fun. And it's really been really cool to have these conversations. You know, when you said freedom, I think we're 5 for 5 in that being part of the answer. And that's been universally the thought process. And I think a lot of the women that we've talked to, they're also representing the people that are most important to them as well, their sisters, their mothers, their clients, et cetera. And so really, really fascinating. So with that being said, Maris and the audience, thank you for being here. Thank you all for listening. Hopefully these are helpful to all of you. And Maris, I so much appreciate your time and the messages that I think you've been able to impress on me and the audience are so impactful. And I'm really excited to get this posted. With that being said, we're going to sign off. Maris, any final thoughts before we disconnect?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's a really, really beautiful conversation. I'm honored to be a part of it. I'd love to continue it whenever possible. Thank you for the work you're doing. Support women. That's what we've been saying the whole day. Support women. Yeah. Bring them on board. Bring them into the conversations early. Then if anybody wants to learn more about my work or working with me or my group, my website is my full name, marispasqualdoran.com. I'd welcome a conversation with anybody. That's where it begins, is a conversation and see if it may be a match. And it does take that first step, just that outreach, and I'd be honored.
Great. All right. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for listening. And Maris, again, thank you so much for your time, and we'll look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you for joining us on Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm your host, Michael Pasquale. At Beyond the Balance Sheet, we explore the stories, strategies, and insights shaping the future of wealth, well-being, and legacy. To keep up with our latest conversations, please subscribe to our podcast and share it with a friend who might enjoy these discussions. If you have any questions, feedback, or topics you'd like us to cover, please reach out to me at michael.pasquale@ubs.com. Until next time, keep looking beyond the balance sheet.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.